Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I have a few recordings that I put in my miscellaneous category, but I thought that I would put them all together here for this podcast because it has a common theme, magic history. We're going to first hear from Kent Cummins as he talks about the history of the Austin Magic Auction, which has been going on for nearly 40 years. This may have some more interest perhaps locally, but I think just from the standpoint of history, I think you might enjoy this. Next we have Arthur Moses, who talks about some of his Houdini collection. He is a noted Houdini collector and well known throughout the world for his collection. And he has acquired a few new things that he talks about. And then finally, we will hear from a couple of the children from Willard the Wizard. We hear from both Gene Willard and from Madeline Willard. And they are joined later in the podcast by Walter Zany Blaney, who relates some of his stories about Willard the Wizard as well. So, first up, let's hear from Kent Cummins here on The Magic Word.
Now, Kent has a great mind in magic and has made many contributions, much contribution to magic in Central Texas and Austin and Texas. And he has always has interesting stuff that no one else has, interesting stories. And he has one tonight. So, Kent, why don't you come up here and share the story, the origins of the Austin Auction.
The world-famous Austin Magic Auction.
Excuse me.
When Claude called me and asked, what was I going to speak on? I said, oh, you know, the origins of the auction, that seems like a good subject for this group this evening. And he said, well, but, you know, people pretty much know that, and proceeded to give me a lot of incorrect information. So I thought, if he doesn't know, that maybe many of you don't. And so I'm going to start with a quiz. And I have a limited number of prizes for people that get the answers right. The first question is, who... And if I told you on the phone, you're not
you
allowed
told
to...
me. I've already gotten it wrong once, so
okay.
I'm not going to...
You're not allowed to... Who was the first auctioneer of the Austin Magic Auction?
Greg Scott.
Who?
The Greg Scott.
He was actually the second. That's a very good guess, but no, that's wrong. Sorry, no prize.
Oh!
Excellent guess. I was the fifth auctioneer. That even surprised me. When I did the research.
What did you say? What was your answer?
The great Scott. Fred Scott Donaldson.
Oh, Fred Scott.
But,
yeah.
So that's completely wrong, but thanks for playing. Yes.
Ron?
Ron Cartledge, not even close. He didn't even know about the auction when it started. Neither did I, by the way.
It wasn't Bob Ford.
It was not Bob Ford. That's a correct... but you don't get a prize for that.
What about Frank Ramirez?
What about Frank Ramirez?
He's dead.
Yeah. And he was not... He was never a primary auctioneer for the Austin Magic Auction. Any other guesses? It looks like I get to keep that prize.
Harry Anderson.
That's good.
Nope.
Was it Judy?
Nope. I said that I was the fifth auctioneer. That's correct. The year before was Steve Farmer, the current president of SAM Assembly 206. The year before that was Lou Horning, who is still very active in the Austin Magic community. The year before that was Fred Scott Donaldson. And the first auctioneer was a guy from San Antonio, an author, a performer, and an escape artist named John Novak.
Oh, yeah.
He was the first auctioneer. Okay, nobody got that one right, so we'll go to question two. Question two is, what year was the first magic auction, Austin magic auction? I'll give you a hint, it was last century.
69? 95.
Yeah.
I
was going to guess.
No,
60.
No.
85. 85, yeah.
No.
80.
No.
73.
83. 73?
84.
Bob Barker, no. Okay. Looks like nobody gets a prize for this one either.
71.
I get to keep my prizes.
Good for you.
The first Austin Magic Auction was in 1975. The year before I got out of Army active duty. So I wasn't aware of it at all, as most of you weren't. Okay, third quiz question. What organization was most responsible for starting the Austin Magic Auction?
IBM Ring 60.
IBM Ring 60 is an excellent guess. It was the only magic club in Austin, but it's wrong.
TAOM.
TAOM is a good guess, also wrong.
the sandwich club?
I didn't have the sandwich shops till Well, actually, I owned them, but no, it had nothing to do with the sandwich shops. We had some auctions there.
Assembly 206?
No, it didn't exist. 1975, and the lead auctioneer, the only auctioneer the first year was John Novak.
Ring 18.
Good guess. Nope. This is fun. I get to keep all my prizes. Okay.
Assembly 52.
It was actually the Fun and Magic Shop in San Antonio, Texas.
Lou Berkey?
Lou Berkey. Because John Novak worked for Lou Berkey. And so the two of them cooked up the idea of having the auction. Now, there's more context, which I'll get to in a minute. But really, without the Fun and Magic Shop, there would never have been an Austin Magic auction.
Why did they do it in Austin?
I'll explain that when I get into the narrative. I really wanted to give away a prize. Okay, to the nearest $100, let me get my notes so that I get this right. To the nearest $100, how much money was taken in from the first Austin Magic auction, which was, as we agreed, in 1975?
$1,900.
$600.
$300.
$420. $887. It was under 100.
When I said 100, that was the closest 100.
I guessed 100 too. I said 100.
Did you? Is that true?
Yes. Not really.
They went over.
Yeah. He's sitting next to you.
He didn't say without going over.
Well, I said to the nearest 100.
I don't see a
blonde girl with big hair. We have to give prizes. Second. This is the commemorative coin from the 20th anniversary Austin Magic Auction. I don't even have half a dozen of them. Now I have even fewer. I think I've got two left now. Good. And so I don't dare give out any more prizes because I'm now out of those things. So here is the story of the Austin Magic Auction. In 1975, Northwest Recreation Center director came to the Scott Magic Company, which was Austin's only magic store, in 75, and said, "Hey, I've got some kids that want to learn magic. I'm going to start a little magic class at the recreation center. Can you sell me some stuff I can teach them?" And Fred said, "I've been looking for ways to get young people more interested in magic. I'd be happy to teach those classes for you." And Fred and Judy developed a magic course. Richard Van Slagle was the other teacher. And among the three of them, they created a beginning course in magic. I think it went for 6 weeks. And they had lots of kids in it. I mean, it was really popular. And they kept teaching. And there were so many kids that were really interested that they started what they called the Junior Ring. IBM Ring 60 was the only magic club in Austin at that time. And so they started a junior club and called it the Junior Ring. It was sponsored by IBM Ring 60. And they thought, what can we do to really get them interested in magic? It'd be nice if we could take them to the TAOM, but by the time they thought of this, it was after September. It was at the TAOM that they thought of it. Said, "I know, we'll have a little convention just for our kids and their families." And they called it the Mini Convention, the Austin Mini Convention. And they thought, we'll have one of everything that a magic convention has. We'll have one show, we'll have one lecture, we'll have one dealer, we'll have, you know, just one of everything. And I don't know, because I wasn't there, exactly how that happened, but they were working with John Novak, and he said, "Hey, I think they may have asked him to bring stuff from Berkey." And he says, "Well, why don't I bring some stuff and we'll auction it off, and that'll be fun." So the magic dealer at the first mini convention was John Novak auctioning off a few items from the Elby Company, the Fun and Magic Shop in San Antonio. It was quite popular, and the next year they had a mini convention. These were held in November. November 20th was the first, 1975 was the first one. They were quite popular. So the next year, they did it again. This time, Fred, the newsletter says, put on his auctioneer's hat. But unlike me, I don't think that was literal. I think it was just figurative. What it is Fred got up and auctioned off a few more items for a little bit more money, you're still talking about somewhere in the $100 range. I mean, it was a very small thing, certainly less than an hour. But it was very popular. I'm going from the newsletter accounts of these. They were all very, very popular. The next year, they did it again, a little bit bigger. Lou Horning was the volunteer auctioneer.
Did he do the bids in a magic square format?
I doubt it. Because they said it was really entertaining.
Yeah, cut that out of the podcast. Go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. So, we are now to 1978. And in 1978, a young kid named Steve Farmer, I know he was a young kid because his dream, he told me back then, was to go to police academy. And he's been retired from the Austin Police Force for quite a few years already now. But, well, we all know that 1978 was a long time ago. Anyway, it was the first time I had ever come to the mini convention. I'm not sure why I came back to Austin 76, but 78 was the first one I had come to. And I watched while Steve Farmer tried to auction off, I don't know, a handful of items. And it was just sad because he didn't know what the stuff was. Literally, they gave him a bag of stuff and said, here, auction the stuff off. And he'd pull something out, and if he knew what it was, he'd tell you. And if he didn't, he'd say, well, I don't know what this is, but, and, you know, just try and figure it out. And because he was trying to figure out what he was auctioning, which certainly wasn't his fault, he was just pulled in to do it, he didn't do a very good job of maintaining the bidding or anything, because he couldn't focus on that. And so I just thought, you know, this has so much more potential. And so I went to Judy after the mini convention, said, Judy, is Steve always the auctioneer? She says, oh, no, we always have to just find some volunteer. I said, well, I'd like to volunteer next year if that's okay. She says, yes, yes, oh, yes, that would be great, yes. And I said, there's just one thing I ask. Is there some way I can get the stuff in advance so that I can do a little something with it? And so the first year that I was auctioneer was 1979. And we had, Steve auctioned off 51 items for $152.15. And in 1979, I auctioned off, doesn't say how.
At the Unitarian Church.
No. This is still at the Recreation Center. You weren't going to get that one right because I don't have that number on this particular thing, but it wound up being over $400. And so, and the reason is I had the stuff in advance. And so I could create things. My favorite example of this is there was a 5-in-1 wand in there. 5-in-1 wand is a hollow magic wand with a piece of elastic in it. It's called 5-in-1 because it will rise into the air, or it will jump into the air, or you can hand it to somebody and it jumps back. I don't even remember what the other couple ones were, but five little trivial things you can do with this funny magic wand. Well, I had seen Lee Grable when I was in the sixth grade, and Lee Grable opened his stage show coming out with a cane, and he flourished the cane, and a big foulard appeared at the end of the cane. And I figured out that you could do that with a 5-in-1 wand, with a small silk. And so when it was time to auction that off, I had extra little silks in my collection, so I just donated one. And I, you know, hit it in my hand or whatever, and I said, this is called a 5-in-1 wand. It'll do this, 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 and the silk appeared at the end of it. And, of course, that's a very cool visual effect, and so immediately people wanted it. And it sold for above retail and was purchased by the guy that put it in the auction. Because he had no idea it would do that. And that was just luck that I happened to know what that particular prop would do. But it also started the business of I would bring my own stuff into it. If something was broken, I'd fix it. If something didn't have instructions, I'd go find the instructions somewhere. Maybe I'd call Berkey, and you know, he'd look through his files or whatever. If something was a production piece but didn't have anything to produce, I'd go find some extra stuff. The advantage of never throwing anything away for, you know, half a century. There's all this extra stuff anyway. And that was really how the auction started becoming a planned event. It had already been popular for 4 years, but that's when it really started going. So in 1980... the sixth annual mini convention, I was still the auctioneer. We had 82 items, and we sold them for $545 with a profit of $108. So that was the first time that we had had over $100 in profit, and the auction ran from 4 to 5:30 p.m. because it's part of the mini convention. Again, it's just part of the convention. And 81, we moved to the Austin Cabaret Theater, which is a little theater that I owned for a year. Never mind how much money I lost in that year. But it was a fantastic place to have magic stuff. And so we had the mini convention at the Austin Cabaret Theater that year. And that year, the auction went from 3:30 to 6 p.m., and we actually charged $3 to get in. That's for the whole convention. And we had 214 items sold. Okay? So it's beginning to build a little bit. Now, the 8th Austin Magic Auction was in 1982. We moved it to the sandwich shop at 504 Congress, which was my place. We charged a dollar, and we skipped all the rest of the mini convention, because by then the auction had become by far the most popular part of the mini convention, and somewhat unique. So I brought the scrapbook just to show you. These are just the flyers for the auction. This is the flyer from the first year of the auction. It's the first time we had an auction flyer, you know, because now it's not a mini convention. Now it's not just targeted to the local people. It's something that we're doing for magic, and we thought that was pretty cool. And this, I put this little notice from the Austin American Statesman. I put that in before Fred noticed. Fred Scott Donaldson was absolutely against promoting the auction in any way that might reach non-magicians. And so we didn't ever do that again while he was alive. Now, this is a one-sided flyer. So that was 82. So here's 83. You can see the flyer looks the same. And you notice I'm wearing that particular coat. And therein lies yet another story. Here's the coat. I'll probably wear it tomorrow, but I won't button it up. I was much smaller in 1982. But this is the coat. And people just assume that I must have gotten this for the auction. But no, when I was still on active duty in the Army, I taught at Fort Lee, Virginia, and a partner and I taught classes to club managers, and this is from the club magazine, and my partner and I both wore the auctioneer-type stuff. We weren't auctioning. We didn't think of it as auction. We just thought of it as, this is a cool way to make a marketing presentation. And so I got the coat while I was still on active duty and when Madras was really in fashion, as a matter of fact. I don't think I got it as a costume. I think I got it, you know, to go out in.
Fashion statement.
Sadly, yes. And this photo was taken by a military friend of mine, Dan Corcoran, and we used that photo in these auction flyers for a very long time. Okay? Now, here's the next year's auction, and this is one of the reasons people have trouble knowing how many auctions we had, because it wasn't exactly one each year. This auction was in November of 83. November was when the mini convention always was, and we just kept the auction in November. This one was in February 85. Because the auction itself was growing so much as a standalone event, we decided, and because November, where magicians are starting their holiday work and everything, we decided to move it to February when magicians really don't usually have much in the way of business. And we thought that would be a better time. People aren't so busy. And so we skipped November of 84 and moved to February of 85. Now, same photo, same basic style. One of the differences is that we used some Paul Osborne clip art. I mean, he didn't know it was clip art, but we used the catalog, you know, things for Paul Osborne. We made copies of them, clipped them out, and put them in when we made the flyer. And this time, instead of a one-page blank on the back, we actually have four pages. This side has all the listings from the Wan Su Troupe, which is Scott and Judy's show. Here's the photo, I mean the flyer from their show. And so that's included there. And then here's a map on how to get to the Unitarian Church. Because that's when we finally moved it to the Unitarian Church. Once I really took over the auction, it started being in my places. I had the Austin Cabaret Theater. I had the sandwich shop in downtown Austin. Margo and I went to the Unitarian Church. So, I mean, this is just, you know, I was providing a place for the auction, basically. Now, here's 86. And now for the first time, we have all these rules and stuff. And here's 87. We've got more of the Paul Osborne clip art. Oh, wait. Something happened. The photo changed. Okay? Uh-huh. If you look at the new photo, you'll see that it's a better photo. It has my face smiling, which is always better for a publicity photo. And it has the cane in my upstage hand, meaning that I don't have a closed position. And you don't even notice that in the first photo until you see the second one and realize, oh, whoever took that photo didn't seem to know about basic posing of people for a photo. He was an excellent photographer technically, but so you see that improvement. And this was taken by Richard Van Slagle, who I mentioned before, one of the organizers of the classes. Now, we're using a lot of Paul Osborne artwork here. And we also have a reprint from the Linking Ring of an article that they wrote about the auction. And the article said, IBM Ring 60 has what is undoubtedly the world's largest annual magic auction. And then for the next 10 years, we quoted that. And the reason they said that is because I wrote the article. And I inserted that quote into the middle of the article. It was true, as far as we knew. So that I could, instead of quoting me, we could quote the Linking Ring. Perfectly legitimate. In terms of marketing, I'm teaching a course on marketing deception even now. I suppose it's somewhat... And there's, you know, more of the... Paul Osborne stuff. Now, we're going to get to that in a minute, but this is a note from a meeting that we had at about that time. The auction was about 10 years old then. And we said, why does Ring 60 hold such a huge annual auction? Because it was getting big by then. In this one, we're advertising that it's a $5,000 magic auction, and that's just, you know, unheard of. When we first went over 2,000, Fred famously said, well, we've topped out. That's as big as it can get. And then when we went over 5,000, he said the same thing. He said the same thing when we went over 10,000. When we went over 20,000, he just stopped talking.
Good idea.
And I was going to, if I needed one more question, I was going to ask, what was the biggest Austin Magic auction? And it was, I think, $44,000.
So, wow.
What year was that?
The last year that we had it. And I'll get to that. But there are five reasons, and this is important, because over 50 volunteers every year working themselves to death, and I was the only auctioneer. And we didn't have silent auction. Everything was from the stage. A little coin trick, big stage illusion. It was all auctioned from the stage, so I had to learn everything we were doing. Now, it was hundreds of items, not thousands of items. But, you know, literally 6 months out of the year, basically, I'm preparing for the auction. And so it was important. Why are we doing this? Is it primarily to make money? And see if you hear that in the five reasons why we do the auction. The auction provides a service to the art of magic, a place for widows to get rid of the stuff in a way where it's spread out to other magicians. Number two, the auction enhances the reputation of IBM Ring 60 and the Austin magic community, clearly. Number three, the auction serves as an effective fundraising tool for the ring. So yes, it is a fundraising tool. That's part of it. Four, the auction effort involves Ring 60 members in a common goal, thus having a team-building effect. And for many years, we think that's probably the single biggest, most important part of the auction, is that it keeps the Austin Magic Club vibrant and alive. And number five, the auction increases community good and awareness. Now, the 1987 flyer, which I'm going to get to in a minute, says over $10,000, the 1988 flyer, says over $10,000 sold in 1987. So this was a really big year for us. And I went around to magic clubs promoting the auction, and I haven't performed this in a long time. There's an awesome auction right here in town, so listen to the rap that I'm putting down. This isn't right. Just a simple little two-hour gig. I'm telling you, brother, this dude is big. We'll probably be selling over 500 tricks at the annual magic auction, IBM Ring 60. It's the biggest magic show you've ever going to see, and I ought to know, the auctioneer, that's me. Now, if you need a big illusion, all you do is ask it, a zigzag lady or a big snake basket, a flying carpet, guillotines galore, and a feature for your show. Start charging more. And you can sell all the stuff that you don't know how to fix. Just bring it to the auction. We'll turn a few tricks.
Because one man's trash is another man's treasure. What gives you pain can give another person pleasure. We've got thimble tricks, card tricks, coin tricks, ball tricks, enormous stage illusions and little bitty small tricks, silk tricks, milk tricks, dangerous escape tricks, spooky tricks, kooky tricks, fakey black drake tricks. We've got metal marvels only Frank Mann would buy, and some junk even the great Scott won't try. We've got wonderful collectibles from some estate. We've got magic that is tragic, and some magic that is great. So put up your hand, the highest bid will take it. You can buy it for less than you could even make it. And if it fizzles in your show, you've got no cause for fear. You can sell it at the magic auction held next year. Now, if you don't want to buy and you don't want to sell, come to the auction anyway for $3. What the hell? Because the punchline to my storyline is easy to see. The Ring 60 Magic Auction is the place to be. Be there or be square. Like, dude, it's what's happening. Totally far out, man. Awesome. Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And that was written for that year's auction. We were doing stuff from Frank Mann. We were doing Don Drake's Black Art, The Wizard's Window. We were doing, I mean, everything in there is related to that specific year. Now, I'll go through this quickly, but notice the new flyer. Paul Osborne called me and said, "You're using my artwork." I said, "Yeah, we're trying to promote your stuff." He says, "Uh-huh, and how is that working?" I said, he says, "Look, I've got a few illusions I want to sell. How about if I draw you a new flyer?" And so he drew the flyer and provided us stage illusions. And I wrote up hints for how to sell stuff. And we made up little ones and big ones. And we used the same one the next year, the same flyer, and the same flyer the next year, and the same flyer the next year. And wait a minute. Is that the same?
No.
Yeah, that's the same flyer next year. That's the same. It's. Whoa, there it is. There's the difference. Notice, new photo.
Oh, okay.
The new photo is by Ann White.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the same dang jacket. Okay. There is no difference, but the biggest difference to me is I'm not wearing a bow tie. And the reason is when I was doing work with Ann White, we decided whether or not I was going to wear a tie in my publicity photos. And I decided when I do wear a tie, when I perform, video tells me I do this. So I've stopped wearing a tie and don't wear one even now. 20th anniversary, got to mention that. 20th anniversary auction. And we had several different flyers for it. And we had our celebrity auction. A big FedEx box came from David Copperfield with stuff donated. And because of that, we were able to present a check to the SYM for over $1,500.
Wow.
Okay. And what's interesting about that is it was still sponsored by IBM Ring 60. But IBM Ring 60 didn't have a junior ring anymore. And so we were happy to support Magic in Youth, even though it was a different club. And so that's how that happened. And there's the thank you note, and those wooden dollars, wooden nickels, are from that year. And then here's the 21st.
Now, what year was the 20th?
The 20th?
20 years after 75, I guess.
95.
95,
yeah,
yes.
It was 95. Yeah, it worked up to that point.
Yeah.
Okay. But we're about to break that. This flyer has a different Ann White photo on it, but it's still from that same sitting. And then we have some different flyers. This one looks pretty boring. It's got a map in the back. And then I particularly like this one. It says, "Don't book any shows for the last weekend of February." And then it tells why, because if you do, you're going to miss the auction, and that would be just a crazy thing to do. There's actually another one underneath here that says that the auction will be February something or other, 1966. I needed a proofreader. But eventually we caught it and reprinted it. That's the good one. And I kind of like this one, mark your calendar. So that was a flyer, I think, that went in a TOM mailing, T-A-O-M mailing. And then this year we apparently decided to save money on printing. I'm guessing this was done by somebody's office copier, but the quality's not as good. And there's a cartoon that Scott Wells did. Okay. And then here's the last thing I need to tell you.
these are them from the current auction. It's this little notice that says, the Austin auction has found a new location, Fort Worth. Auction in early 1999. And the story behind that is, and then I'll wrap this up, the story behind that is that I got an opportunity to lecture in New Zealand. New Zealand is the place my wife really, really, really wanted to go. And the timing was February, which is like their summer. Okay, and I was going to be back in time for the auction, but I wasn't going to be back in time for all the prep. And so we had a meeting around the swimming pool at David Luther's house in South Austin of all the key players. It's like, all right, I can come back and be the main auctioneer, but we need somebody to do all the other stuff. And Opie Houston said that he would do it, but Opie Houston didn't have a sandwich shop or a cabaret theater or go to the Unitarian Church or have Westgate Mall, which is the biggest place we ever had the thing. All of those, none of those places were available anymore. He was unable, and he had lots of help, and they were unable to find a place. And so they just quietly didn't have an auction because they couldn't find a place to do it. And so when I came back, there was no auction. And then by then, the mood had passed, and we were all exhausted from 22 years of doing the auction anyway. And so when Fort Worth called and said, hey, how about if we take it up? We talked. We, the board of IBM Ring 60, and said, you know what? Let's let them do that for a while. And so with our blessing, they started the auction. And if it weren't for Ron, they'd probably still have the auction and we wouldn't. But Ron, in 1993, was an auction volunteer, and then he brought it back, and now it's run by SAM 206 instead of IBM Ring 60. And by design, it's not quite as big as it had gotten, because we sometimes auction until 1 or 2 in the morning. I mean, we just auctioned until everything was gone, and that's crazy. And I can tell you, you know, what year we started with the silent auction and all of the different things. I'm compiling as accurate a history as possible. Thank you for coming to the world-famous Austin Magic Auction.
Introducing Kent Cummins during that part of the podcast was Claude Crowe. Now let's hear from Arthur Moses on Houdini and Hardeen.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and we are at the Austin Magic Auction. There are a lot of really cool things that are going up for sale, over almost 2,000 silent auction bids, another 250 up for a live auction. And the night before, we always have a collector's meeting. Well, one of the people who had given a short presentation was Mr. Arthur Moses, that many of you know as being a major Houdini collector throughout the world. He is well known. Hello, Arthur.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. Glad to have you back again. I enjoyed staying at your home whenever we did the Houdini seance a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
Now, have they ever talked about bringing this back to Fort Worth, by the way, that seance?
Yes and no. It was offered again, and we, at this point, declined. It's a lot of work.
A lot of work.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun for one time.
Been there, done that. Now, yeah,
move on.
Yeah, let's move on to something else, because you really did put in a lot of effort. You can kind of see behind the scenes.
Thanks.
Yeah,
thank you.
I appreciate that, everything that you had done.
And you were great.
Well, thank you. Mutual Admiration Society here. But one of the things I was going to talk about, you had shown a couple of things that you picked up at the Potter & Potter auction last year.
Correct.
Which were some comic books, or actually some original art.
The proof pages. Uh-huh. And Gabe, who runs the Potter & Potter, as he described it in the catalog, they knew they were comic book proof pages, mm-hmm. But they didn't know what comic book. Mm-hmm. And I thought I knew one of two different that it was, and so I went ahead and bid, and I bought the lot. And then when I got home, I went through quite a few comics in my collection to match up the pages, and indeed, it ended up to be the 1960 The World Around Us. Mm-hmm. Comic, which has been also subsequently in 1961 republished in several other editions, several other languages from England and Australia, and actually last night I learned from Sweden there is a Dutch edition and a, what is the other, I think a Turkish edition, but I could be wrong on that one. As I think of what we talked about last night.
Well, but there was only just the one comic. In other words, it was not part of a series.
Right.
So it was a one-off with
right, and
written
published
in
different languages.
Yeah.
And these proof pages they're large. They're like 18 inches by 24 inches tall.
I was amazed when you showed
markups.
That. I didn't know the comic books were drawn that large. You know, you see them in smaller
right.
form. I guess they must shrink them down, obviously, and then someone colors them in and
right.
all that. So this was the uncolored illustrations.
Right. These were the absolute right, the original illustrations.
How do you
markups.
Plan on displaying that? You're going to put that alongside of one of the pages from them?
I'm still working on some ideas. You know, right now you saw the folder I had them in last night. I just keep them in the closet with the hundreds of other items.
Yes.
But I would like to display them better.
And you have a book that you're going to, you're working on, or now you found something else you said you're going to have to add to it, or what was the
right.
book there?
Well, it was the Houdini periodical bibliography that I did with Ancient Art Magic about 10 years ago, and I've been working on an updated edition, which is almost ready to go. It'll be available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It'll be at a much better price point than the prior edition, and almost double the listings of the prior edition. We're probably, and I haven't totaled up yet, but I think there's over 2,000 listings of
wow.
where Houdini printed articles can be, whether it be magazines, journals, newsletters, not books, but you know, just from a periodical, and nothing online, only it's got to be a printed version. And there's going to be over 90 photographs.
Now, are these things exclusively from your collection or things that you know of that are aware of living in the world somewhere that you may not
probably
own?
Probably 95% is in my collection.
Okay.
And the book shows little asterisks by each one, which is sort of the only self-serving part of the book because it helps me keep track for myself of what I have and
because
what I don't
have. Because you have a total
have.
Of how many now? Items, Houdini items?
Well, I've got over 5,000 Houdini items in total.
When you said last night 5,200, I thought, well, that's interesting because he died when he was age 52.
Yeah. And there's so, you know, certainly a lot of it is period pieces.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is contemporary. You know, even one of the other pieces I brought last night was a book from India that's in the Tamil language.
Tamil.
And it is a modern, I mean, it was printed like, I think, either in 2013 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, look how that's the other side of the world to us. And he's still a known, well-known figure there in India.
Yeah. Wow.
And I've got, you know, there's Russian books that have come out recently.
It's amazing when you think about Americans, English-speaking
right.
people know who Houdini was. There was a stamp struck for him. But to think in other languages that, now, did he ever tour to India? Did he perform?
Did not. He, you know, of course, England, Australia,
sure.
France, Germany.
Germany.
But he never
went to Asian countries.
Right, never did the Far East.
But yet they are aware of who he is, and still to this day, it's amazing.
Absolutely.
Wow.
He's
in their dictionary just like he is ours,
I guess,
to do a Houdini or,
yes.
you know, okay, to escape. Now, another thing, then, briefly, as we start to kind of wrap up, that you talked briefly about Hardin then last evening, and
right.
he was the successor to, first of all, of course, he'd worked with his brother, and Hardin's real name was Dash?
Well, that's what the nickname was Dash,
okay.
or Ardezo, which was really the Hungarian, was Theodore.
Okay, Theodore, okay.
Right.
And then the two of them, he and Eric or Harry, had worked together.
Sure,
and
as
you
young
said,
boys.
I did not know that Hardin was the one who actually invented the subtrunk.
Right, really the metamorphosis.
He did that first.
Houdini and his, you know, Dash did it, and when Bess came along, you know, Houdini did... a quick change.
Yeah.
And because Dash was big, you know, he was over 6 foot tall, and he was a little, not, I'm not going to say clumsy, but he
almost
was just
a foot taller than his brother.
Correct, and he was just larger and wasn't able to get in and out as quick as Bess was, who was just a little spit of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And
less than 100 pounds. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Dash really, I think, came up with that.
Along with that, one of the things that you mentioned, we were talking about the milk can escape, and you were saying that he probably had problems getting into that because of his height, as opposed to Houdini.
Right. The milk can, I would have to surmise, and I do not know this part of the facts of Hardin's milk can, because Hardin did do the milk can quite a bit in his own show. Was it a different milk can? Because, again,
it might be one floating around out there, then.
I've actually been in the Houdini milk can, and I'm 6 foot tall, and it was hard for me to crouch and crunch low enough, and I could not get low enough to get the lid on.
And you told a story about last night. Was it Hardin or Houdini who almost died one time?
Hardin was doing the... had had two of Houdini's assistants, James Collins and Jim Vickery, who worked with Hardeen after Houdini had passed. And there was, of course, a password, a signal to give, if you know, in mm-hmm. any professional.
Safe word, like 50 you know, Shades of Grey.
And Hardeen got stuck in the tank, mm-hmm. and he had to give his safe word, little knock or however, and if he was not saved, he had been in under 3 minutes, over 3 minutes, mm-hmm. and they picked up on the signal and were able to get him out.
You said another 12 or 20 seconds?
He said another 15, 20 seconds. I mean, he was in 3 minutes, and yeah. he said, you know, a few more 20 seconds, he'd have been drowned.
Wow.
So but it was a close call.
He did die in 1945, natural causes,
yes.
his old age?
Okay. Just natural causes.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't get punched or anything? It was
correct.
Nothing,
no, okay. nothing
dramatic.
Nothing like that.
Yeah.
And but he performed, you know, he was doing off-Broadway, like Hell's a Poppin', mm-hmm. which was a theater production, I think through 1943, I know. I'm not sure about 1944, but I know. So he was working up until, you know, literally the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Whether
wow.
it was magic or on stage,
and
Broadway.
The stuff that was his, that went on then to Sid Radner, or how did...
Well, he, I think, willed it, or however the give was, to Hardeen Jr., who was Jeffrey.
Theodore's son.
No, it was a well-known magician... I cannot remember his first name. I apologize,
okay.
but it's Jeffrey with a G,
mm-hmm.
and he was known as Hardeen Jr. And then there was, you know, between the things that they found even years after Houdini passed in a trunk in the basement of the house in New York, Sid Radner was mm-hmm. able to get part of the collection as well.
And some of that went to
through
the
Hardeen
collection on Niagara Falls, which of course later. Was lost in a
fire. I think that was a very little.
Oh,
little
really?
Bit,
okay.
Because that was fully on loan to the Canadian owner of the mm-hmm. of that museum.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very small museum, very little other than the torture cell.
Yeah, I remember the torture cell. I went to that museum once, and glad I did, because
right.
it burned when? Probably in 90 something?
Correct.
Yeah.
It'd be
okay.
back 20 years ago.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks. And it was great talking with you again. And you're
always
continuing
to
look for Houdini stuff. And so mm-hmm. if anybody has something that you think might be of interest, they can get in touch with you. How?
Through my website, which is www.houdinispeaksout.com.
Houdinispeaksout.com.
Catch me there.
Great. Thank you, Arthur, very much. I'd ask you before what your magic word is, I think, when I was with you before. I'd forgotten. I'm sure I did, but if I didn't, what would be your magic word? What's something that's important to you? What's your core value? What is it that means something to you personally, maybe magic related or not?
Character.
Ooh, I like that.
Character.
Have to have good character.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks. That was Arthur Moses speaking on the MagicWordPodcast.com. Till next time, Scotty out.
Wrapping up this trio of recordings, we have Madeline and Gene Willard, who are children of the late, great Willard the Wizard. Joining us later in the recording was Walter Blaney. We happened to all be together for a funeral in recognition of the passing of Doug Carnegie, who was the dean of the Society of American Magicians Assembly 19 here in Houston. There were several other magicians in attendance, but I pulled a few of these aside just to talk about some old times that I think you will enjoy.
Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com, and I've got with me Mr. Gene Willard. Hi there, Gene.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. So tell me, we were starting to talk about the tent, and when your dad, Willard the Wizard was doing his tent shows, and obviously he had no sound. I guess there was no electricity. So what kind of lighting did they use?
Well, no, we had electricity most of the time. Matter of fact,
a generator or something?
Yeah, well, we had our own light lamp, but that was back until the war started out, and then we would get city power.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the family, and we probably have not had more than 5 or 10 men at the most working for us.
Yeah.
When we came down in this part of the country back in the late 40s, in 1948, we only had 3 men working for our entire show. It was a family
wow.
and those 3 men. And all we had to do is I'd drive the trucks, and that's it.
Well, now how many people were in the family that added to those 3
well,
people?
Well, that was me and my mom and my sisters and me, and that was it. And my
yeah.
sister Rosemary and her husband's really the one that did all the work. James White.
Putting up the tent and everything.
Yeah. But when you moved into town, most of the local help, just give them free tickets. That's the way,
I see.
That's the way circuses and carnivals move. They give the local people and kids tickets to go, to make the rides and everything. Yeah.
You know, I always say the first job I ever had in my life was working for the circus. I was, I think I was either 8 or 10 years old. My dad took me to a Big Top circus. And at the end, they said, we just need men to help tear down the Big Top and everything as we pack up. And so I asked my dad if I can help be a roustabout. He said, yeah. So he went and watched me as I did. And, of course, I'm too small to do anything. And so when the tent went down, I would get the flags in the middle. And, and then I would roll them up and brought them back. And I lined up with everybody else, and I got $2 for that. Now, this would have been probably in the 50s sometime, maybe 1958 or 59. Anyhow, that in later years, when I was in college, the same tent or circus came back to town. They asked for men. I went and helped. Now, this time I worked a lot harder, of course, and tearing down the Big Top. Lined up, got the same $2 payment. So the payment hadn't changed in all those years. But giving away free tickets would have been a good idea.
Well, that's the way we moved the show. One thing my dad was really, really phenomenal about it was flying the flag. You mentioned flags.
Yep.
You had to have the flags up. You always say, keep the flags flying. You know the town. You know the show's in town.
Oh, good point.
Or the circus comes to town.
Sure.
Yeah. He's talking about circus. You heard this on the news yesterday where the Ringling Brothers are going to come in and they're going to do with it.
With the elephants, yeah.
I never had a circus without elephants.
That's right. I don't know. That is a strange thing to me, too. I was starting to talk to you about the sound. So even though we had electricity, they didn't have speakers and stuff that you brought along.
Yeah, we had music for the show. We had two big turntables backstage and records and everything like that. But that never. But as far as a microphone or like that, he just never used one. I mean, even when they was because if you. The first kind that came out on the stage was the ones that you stand on the stage and you had to operate around it.
Yeah.
Until you had the ones where you could put on your lapel.
Lapel, like. Right.
But, no. As far as our sound system, we had music, and we had two big
turntables.
Turntables, yeah, right.
And then just had a speaker going from that or something, a microphone next to the...
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
That's okay.
Scott Wells, Madeline.
Yeah, I know.
You look familiar. What's your name?
Doug Carnegie's.
So going back just to the sound, he had a pretty strong voice. Madeline, you come over here a sec. I'm on a microphone. Got Madeline Willard with us, and sister of Eugene. And so you worked also with Harry.
Yes, I did.
A lot, and Francis and everybody else.
Yes, I did.
And we were talking about the microphone, the fact that your dad had, I guess, a strong voice, and he could really project the whole theater then.
Yes.
Did he speak to you like that at home?
Daddy was very soft.
Was he?
Yes, very soft.
Great, great. What great story comes to mind about the Willard the Wizard show?
Well,
you've recounted many times, I'm
sure.
Well,
I think the things that I remember the most was we would be doing some playing, color books or something. Dad says, come here a minute, I want to show you something. And we'd go backstage and he'd have a trunk set up and he'd say, now, just do what I ask you. He said, okay. You just get in the trunk. He said, you put your arm this way? No. Put your arm. No, okay. Put your leg this way. And then he says, now, you've heard the routine before when you've seen your mother do it? He said, when I blow the whistle or clap my hands, you come out of the trunk like this. Okay. He said, now, I'm going to do that as a third illusion. That's all the rehearsal we got.
That was it. The next thing you know.
I have never met a person on stage who was more gentle, more courteous to an assistant, and continually almost in tune with what the person was going to, except once. And I had to do the sword box in my sister Rosemary's place, and I really wasn't familiar with it, just being put in it and told, we'll put the swords in. He didn't do it.
Right.
For some reason, the sword got stuck where it shouldn't have, and it was going in my arm, and Dad just kept pushing that sword, and I was in the way.
Yeah.
So that was that's it. That's only sign of brutality.
I tell you, people, you know, non-magicians or people that's not connected with the show business, you can't really appreciate this until you work backstage when things go wrong.
Yeah.
You know that, performing magic,
sure.
You know. And trying to talk your way out of it, you know.
Right. So that way to the audience, it doesn't look like anything's going wrong.
Right, you know.
Stage hands and assistants aside from the
That's right.
Dad was a man that stepped out of the mid-Victorian era, which was hard on us in one way in normal life, but on the stage, he was a gentleman. He truly was.
Now, how many people would fit under the tent? I mean, what kind of size audience they had?
The biggest one he had back in the late 30s was when Madeline was born. It was seen about 900.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and then we had bleachers in the back.
Yeah.
That was for when the colored people were there.
Yeah.
Bob Hill heard those stories.
Bob Hill,
will you tell
them? Yeah, seen about 900.
Bob Hill told the story about Dad putting his family on the front row, behind the spot.
Taking them from the back of the tent, moving right up front.
Just
so everybody.
The hails.
Wow. Now, what year would that have been? I've been the 40s, 50s?
The 40s,
yeah.
And,
which back then, with color separation and segregation, I guess, that was, boy.
And Bob said one day a county official approached, and they're friendly to Dad, and he walked over and put my little sister or brother, I believe, was in Bob's mother's arms.
I'll be. Uh-huh.
And he said she has to get the baby back to the dressing room. Never said another word, and they never stayed.
She was talking about Bob.
Bob would cry.
You know Bob Hill?
Oh, I remember him. Sure
okay.
Do. Sure do.
We're talking about the.
He used to have a magic shop, I believe, then too, didn't he?
Well, he.
I'm not thinking.
He set up at a lot of the convention. He had a dealer's room.
Yes.
But in 1949, we showed St. Augustine, Texas. Mm-hmm. That's where we met Bob for the first time. And I don't know how Bob got acquainted with Daddy, but anyway, he told Bob and his wife, he said, you come down and give me some tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob and his wife came down right before the show, and Daddy took and set Bob and his wife right on the front row.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that were sponsoring the shows had told my dad, Mr. Lurcher, you can't let them colored people sit up on that front row like that. They need to be in the back. He said, they're going to sit right there. They're my guests. And he said, if they don't sit there, and they said, well, you just can't let them sit there. And he said, well, we won't have a show tonight.
Just like that.
I would cry when he tell a story.
Yeah.
And Barbara.
Bob, he's brought the world, this family, ever since.
Yeah.
Bob
and Claire would come to set, and Mother would be in the trailer with Claire. And Bob and Dad would go off and talk magic.
Yeah.
And he said I was practically just a little more than a teenager. And he said here he was wanting me to learn magic.
Yeah.
And when Barbara was born, Claire said, your dad made a screen crib for Gloria, and he would put lids with water in them so the ants wouldn't get out there on the... up in the crib.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Yeah, sure.
And one day I remember looking out there, and Dad had, they had Barbara and Gloria in the crib playing as babies in the crib.
Yeah.
But they were beautiful, beautiful people to magic, and so many stories about Bob and Beverly. And
Bergeron isn't here, by the way, then, too. You know, Bev, now, you guys know Bev probably how long? I'm going to say since...
We met Bev in LaPorte, Texas when he came around the tent when we were showing LaPorte.
Yeah.
But I really got to know Doug and Bev real well at the convention, 1940 convention here in Houston.
Yeah.
And when we showed the music hall. And that's the first time when I met Doug. But... Well, Bev, he just followed us all around. And
did Bev work with you guys?
He did.
He was an assistant.
Maybe there's some pieces missing here. I remember 1948, before the Rice Hotel convention.
Okay.
And we were in Baytown, and it was wonderful to have an 8-year-old brother out in the summertime, because there were all these wonderful kids that came around, and it was good. And Bev and Doug were there, and Gene McIntosh, Gene to Gene, and so we just kind of had a little group of big brothers there. And then later on in September, we went to the Magic Convention, and I was 10 years old. And the only thing I didn't like about it, I had too many big brothers telling me not to punch the elevator button.
Bev, when he came out of the service, it was by 1956, after my mother died in 1953, this is when he started, when Bev worked with him for a while. Yeah. Because I told my dad one time, I said, he could do a show by himself. I come, Dad, you don't need all this help, my friend. Just go ahead and get on stage and do it. You know, and I'd go down there and help him with the baggage and stuff, and he'd get out and do a regular show by himself.
Bev, you mean?
Yeah. No, my dad.
Oh, Harry. Yeah.
Yeah. He'd just do it. I said, stick to your small stuff, you know.
Now, who built the illusions? Did he build all of his own stuff, or?
Some of them come from Abbott, and some of them come from, most of it still come from Fair.
Okay.
Fair.
And the box trick he had.
Well, the box, yeah, he built the box trick, and the box himself, it was made out of wood, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would have the Boy Scouts.
The Boy Scouts sometimes?
Boy Scouts, and he'd take a Boy Scout in there with him.
Yeah, and give them free tickets, I guess, then, too.
Well, he put them in the box.
Oh, he put them in the box.
Or the Scoutmaster went in the box.
Okay, that's clever.
And, you know,
Dad, I'll tell you, Dad had to use a pocket knife.
Uh-huh.
To get out of the box.
Oh, okay.
And one night we was out on the stage, he got in the box, and he took his coat off, and he was fooling around like, and I said, what's the problem? He said, I don't have my knife. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I'll figure out something. And he got down in the box. And I asked him, I said, what did you do? And he said, I used my fingernail.
To get out.
To get out.
Instead of the knife.
Yeah, Dad would always kind of not say anything, but the audience picked it up. And he said, well, now, he said, instead of using one of my assistants, we're going to use one of the Boy Scouts. Well, they think, oh, I hope I did the box right.
Well, there's Walter Blaney walking over here then, too. So, anyhow,
yeah.
I just want to say thank you guys very much.
Okay.
I just wanted to get a couple things. Hey, Walter, want to say hi? Hello.
Hi. Do I have to say hi?
That's it.
Can I say howdy?
Howdy, that's right.
That's
it's okay. We were just talking about Willard the Wizard. They were just telling the story.
They
were talking
about
Willard, Willard the Wizard. I've never heard of him.
Hey, heard of Blaney the Wizard? Zany Blaney.
We were talking about the box.
Of their family.
We were talking
yeah,
about
I know.
Daddy getting out of the box, you know, and he used to take a little boy in the box with him.
Uh-huh.
And in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the little boy standing off the right of the stage with a man there. And he asked the little boy, he said, come on up on the stage. He said, can you go in the box with me? And the little kid broke away and come up on the stage. And,
yeah.
Well, anyway, to make a long story short, he was the governor of Louisiana's son.
Oh, fine.
And after he... And the next morning, he found out. He said that this little boy had a heart murmur, and he said, "God, I don't know what happened to that kid, but he got sick in that box."
My.
But he used to have to put a hood over his face; they couldn't.
Oh, because he had to get out. Once he got inside there, they give it.
Well, he put a hood over the kid,
yeah.
kid's neck.
Now, how old was he? It's like a 10 years old or something.
I don't know. Yeah, he was probably 8 or 9, I
yeah.
guess. Yeah.
And,
Interesting. They loved you guys.
Do you have a favorite story? I was just recording stories, like of seeing Willard the Wizard.
Well, yeah, I got to see the big tent show.
Yeah.
It was just marvelous.
What sticks out in your mind? Do you remember
On Monday he did a full evening show, and I went back the next day, Tuesday. Everything was different, completely different
wow.
show. Wednesday, I go back.
Well, they didn't have much rehearsal from what you were telling me. They just said, okay, you do this
rehearsed.
And that.
Never
and on Wednesday, another third whole show, all different.
Yeah.
So these farmers came from 50 miles around. I remember it was in Weldon, Texas, where I had a good friend that lived there. My friend Jimmy Walker.
That wasn't Jimmy, was it? Jimmy Walker?
Jimmy
yeah,
Walker,
sure.
Yeah.
I remember you talking
still
about
lives
him.
Still there, yeah.
yeah.
And we went to see the show. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, they do the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday show again.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Sunday they were off. Tore down the tent.
Yes,
the next
yep. There was a blue law, and that respected the blue laws. No show
on Sundays,
Sunday.
Right?
Never on Sunday.
Right.
But oh God! Well, he had one of the great levitations of all time.
That's what I was thinking.
A couch put out right next to the footlights.
Yeah.
On the apron, right next to the crowd.
Right.
And she rose up off that couch, you know, and he's standing right there.
Oh, so many stories.
And I had the hood brought up from the audience. It was examined, and he took that and passed it over.
Yeah.
And then he did it again.
Now, did that amaze you? That was long before your ladder levitation.
I didn't know how things worked back then. But I remember one night he was saying, "Rise, Fernanda.
Rise. Fernanda, you will arise."
And she didn't rise. And he kept saying, "Rise, Fernanda." He said, "Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen." And he went back and he heard somebody go, "Ow!" And then he came back out, "Fernanda, rise, she rose."
It was Fernando, you all.
What was I saying?
You said it. Just move the words around.
Was it Fernanda?
You said rise, Fernando, but it was Fernando, you will rise. And he didn't do that much. Rise. He only did it when a few magicians were in the audience because they knew where Fernando.
He used that word. He used that name, Fernando, doing the Azra. You know when they put the sheet over the girl and the girl goes up and he pulls the sheet off, fires the gun, and he. They would say, "Fernando, you will arise." You know. Then he pulled the sheet off and said, "Where's the girl?" And the girl comes running up down the aisle.
Yeah. A couple of times, we didn't know he was out there, and he came up on the stage to help him, which was hysterical.
Who did? Blackstone?
Blackstone.
Junior?
Dad,
senior?
Daddy stuck him to the chairs one night. But Dad would, if he knew Blackstone was out, Mother say he said, "Blackstone's out." Because we couldn't say Harry. God, we just went, "Don't name your kid Harry." But Harry Blackstone was in the audience.
Have you ever heard story?
Yeah.
About Blackstone when he was doing the Azra in one of the big cities.
Blackstone Senior?
Yeah. Blackstone Senior. He's doing the Azra. And he hired a new boy, a new kid. To do the Azra, and anyway, I think they dressed the kid up like a devil, and they're gonna make the devil disappear or something. Anyway, the theaters that Blackstone and Michonne was both of them were together, and they were having Uncle Tom's Cabin was the performance going on next door. And they had rehearsed a show for the kid to go around and come down around the theater and come down the aisle. And he told the boy, says, "When I say, 'Where's that devil? Where in the blazes is that devil?' you come run down the aisle." Well, the kid got mixed up and went next door. And he was late because a policeman had stopped him out there on the street. Now, I didn't make this story up. I heard this on some of the magicians over the years. That he got in the wrong theater and come down the aisle. And here I am.
A willing assistant serves the coffee. They would say there are no prima donnas around. No prima donnas on my show. I wish sometime we could tell the humor. That's very low key humor. There'll be no prima donnas.
No prima donnas, on our show. Everybody helped everybody. Like you said, it was the whole family, I guess, that kind of pitched in and put up the tent and tore it all down and everything.
We had such a routine. I said one time in front of Doug, a couple of conventions ago, I said, "We had such a routine that we could do it in our sleep." Doug said, "Sometimes you did."
Sometimes you did.
Sometimes you did. I was talking one day about Dad's trucks, and I wanted to tell somebody something about how he got the license plates for the trucks and costs of the state line.
Sure.
And so poor little Doug is just embarrassing. I said, "Walter, remember what was that?" I asked them questions because I was a lot smaller. So I said, "Doug, something about the license." He says, "Madeline, your dad didn't have truck license." I said, "What did he have?" He said, "He didn't have license at all. He painted them all."
Oh, he painted all the license?
That's what Doug would always, this sense of humor. He'd paint them all.
Kept the same numbers all the time. Then.
Bill was talking about Blackstone. And I understand that this is a true story. That Blackstone was doing the Vanishing Birdcage one night.
Yeah.
And poof, it's gone. But the pole broke and the cage went out into the
audience.
Okay.
But it was dark and nobody knew, and it was a hell of a trick, you know.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the show, they're packing up, and one of his assistants walked over and says, Mr. Blackstone, there's a lady from the audience that wants to give you something. And he says, I'm busy. I don't have time now. We just finished the show.
Right.
He said, I think you should see
make
her.
Time for her. Yeah.
And so she came up, and she looked around. Nobody was looking. She said, I think this is yours. It went into my lap when that little bird vanished. And, oh, my gosh, and he hugged her.
Yeah.
And we got his cage back. And it just landed in her lap.
And he didn't think anything more about it.
She didn't say, oh, look what I got.
Yeah.
She played along.
You know why he wouldn't? He hesitated to meet anyone right after the show? Gene can tell you this. We would hug him, but he would do push us away. When you hug my dad, he was like hugging a sponge, the water.
He'd be so hot and sweaty
those
from working.
Those old tuxedos, you know, those weren't polyester.
Yeah.
And they were real stuff. And the tails and all, and they use a Clorox bottle for collar. So it was a lot. And I could look at him, and it's just dripping. And he hardly, you know, perspired, didn't they?
Sure.
But he was just wringing wet, and he was terrified of pneumonia.
Hmm.
And he'd make us all go and get out of the wet clothes, you know, and hang them up and then clean them. But he didn't want other people to come up and
give him a hug after him.
Crank, you know,
talk to him afterwards.
Damp hand, you know, mm-hmm. A soggy hand.
Yeah, and to talk about the old timers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gene's memories and my memories of Blackstone and Virgil coming out to see Dad are just wonderful. Things.
Must have been a special time.
We didn't realize it.
Of course you don't.
It was just like talking to you.
Well, that's what I feel about now. Yeah, you know, 20 years from now, I think that someone hear these stories, they'll think, man, those were the grand old times. You
some young fellas at the convention were going on, but you know Beverly Bershon. I said, well, yeah, I know Beverly Bershon.
Yeah.
They're going on Bevan Rebo, the clown, and all this stuff, and I thought, Beverly? You know, that.
Yeah, same Bev
you're
talking about?
Yeah, and I realized that you fellas have made the grade there. Gee, you grow up with someone you don't know.
Yeah, you know him a different way.
I remember Bev came to see my state show in, was it near Baytown? It wasn't Baytown, that's where Bev was from. I forget what the town was, but he came back after the show. We've been friends ever since, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still in college back then. And then he was a couple years behind me. And then he went to Texas University also.
Well, that's right. I forgot. Bev went to University of Texas then, too.
Yeah, he was in our magic group there.
You and him and Gene Anderson?
And Gene Anderson. Well, he came later.
Yeah.
But I was going back to Austin to do shows for banquets and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they would hear that I was coming. And I'd tell them how I knew him.
Yeah.
And they'd come see my show at the banquet. You know, mm-hmm. I'd arrange for them to come in and see the show.
Right.
And then we'd all go out and have hamburgers afterwards, and it was fun.
Yeah.
Those are good old fun days, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Bev's still going.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah, he's not here today, I guess.
I asked Mother one time, I said, Mother, this was in the days when the fellas would wear white shoes and white slacks and damper dressing, you know, and I'd say, Mother, why in the world did they come out here? And Dad would make them in the night, maybe out in the sleeping tent.
Yeah.
And one of our funny stories, we were in the cookhouse, and he had Glenn Pope. Do you remember the stories of Glenn Pope, the great Glenn Pope?
No.
Well, he was one of the dashing John Calvert folks come from Paris. He was sitting in there, and when you ate, Scott, even they'd say, have some more navy beans or something. Okay. And he dumped that whole, he kept pushing it back. Dad would just, the beans went over on his suit.
Oh, my.
But when you look out, if it were raining, those trouser legs would be pushed up, their shoes would be off, and they'd be out there pushing trucks. I don't care who they were.
Yeah.
It's just,
then whenever you were finished, you'd roll back down, clean off your feet. And
I said, Mother, why do they do that? She says, they're all Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer when it comes to the show out on the road.
Oh, my. Well, thank you guys very much.
Okay.
Those are very good. Thank you. So, Gene Willard, Walter Blaney, and Madeline Willard. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Scott.
You bet. Scotty out.
Well, I guess you know by now that the Bev they were referring to was Bev Bergeron, who was Rebo the Clown with Mark Wilson in the Magic Land of Alakazam. He was one of the three guys who hung around together. It was Doug Carnegie and Gene DeGene and Bev Bergeron. Anyhow, thank you very much for indulging me and allowing me to broadcast this information that might be of more local interest than it is on a global nature, but perhaps some of this information might be of particular interest to you collectors and magic historians out in the audience. So thanks again, and until next time, please stay safe, get booked, and don't text while driving. This is Scotty out.